Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Exactly 1 year ago today on this program, we took note of the fact the Dow still hadn't caught up to the level at which it began the new millennium. Let's rewind to last New Year's Eve.
The Dow Industrials closed at almost 10,500 this afternoon. On this day in 1999, the blue chips were 1,000 points higher.
Okay, so where's the Dow a year later? Well, at least tonight, Wall Street can party like it's 1999. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. As we bid farewell to 2010, thanks for making us a part of your New Year's Eve. Let's end the year with a comparison. The Dow Jones Industrials grew around 11% in the past year, adding more than 1,000 points. Good news, yes, but for the record, the Dow's finish today wasn't much above where it ended in 1999. Not to be cynical, but one more comparison, the 11% gain for the Dow this year didn't keep pace with the price of oil, which ends the year up 12%. We'll have more fun with numbers a little later in the broadcast. It turns out a lot of air travelers didn't have to wait until next year to get home after all. Airlines are reporting they've pretty much finished rebooking tens of thousands of passengers whose flights were canceled by that nasty winter storm over the Christmas weekend. Some of those stranded travelers have complained and gotten help using 140 characters. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
Twitter. It's a great place to vent. Just ask college senior Alex Bruno. He says Delta lost his luggage and he called and called without answers, so he tweeted.
Dear Delta, please find my bags. I need my clothes back. Thank you. Flying sucks.
And within an hour, someone from Delta Assist, a team of Twitter-trained customer service agents, tweeted back, apologizing and linking to contact information for the baggage department. It hasn't gotten Bruno's clothes back, but he says,
at least they were there to say sorry.
Delta spokesperson Susan Elliott says Twitter is another way for the airline to be in touch with customers, sometimes really, really frustrated customers, especially during this recent snowstorm.
At Delta Assist really helped as kind of an escape valve to catch some of those customers that needed the most immediate assistance.
It wasn't just Delta. Savvy Twitterers were able to rebook flights and get assistance from JetBlue. And a lot of companies, from Comcast to Microsoft, recognize the importance of this sort of customer service. Paul Gillen is a social media and marketing expert.
The front lines of customer service are moving to Twitter because of its speed. And the realization that when people have problems, they generally want to get them resolved right now.
One worry Gillen has about the trend, quick responses to our grumpy tweets could mean that we're all primed to complain. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
A lot of Americans don't even know what long-term care insurance is, let alone own a policy for themselves. That's a big reason that as of today, MetLife is no longer selling it. Long-term care insurance covers the kind of help you might need as you get older. Help feeding yourself, bathing, cooking. It can cover a full-blown nursing home or just a home care aide. But the policies are getting more expensive for the insurance companies still selling them. Gregory Warner reports from the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia.
For the last 5 or 6 years, Ellen Fillion has been paying for her mom's nursing home using the money she'd saved up for her own retirement. Ellen is 66. Her mom is 97.
She is in a very, very nice nursing home. But at $6,000 a month, your money goes pretty fast.
Ellen didn't want the same thing to happen to her kids, so she shopped around for long-term care insurance for herself and her husband that would pay for a nursing home if the time came. Then she looked at the price tag, over $1,000 a month.
We just didn't think that we could afford the long-term care insurance. Now, everybody doesn't end up in a nursing home. The ideal is that you go out like the incandescent light bulb. The light burns until it goes out.
So you're just, you and your husband are hoping to just kind of blink out one day.
Yes, that's the plan.
Ann Tumlinson with the consulting firm Avalier Health is an expert in this kind of insurance and in these kinds of excuses.
We are living in denial, yes.
Tumlinson has trouble explaining to people what she does for a living. Long-term care insurance, they say. When the time comes, most people sell the house to pay for the nursing home.
And, you know, the whole entire assisted living industry has been fueled not by insurance payments, but by home equity. But the problem is you can run out of money. You end up on Medicaid, and Medicaid does not have very many choices.
Or your kids start picking up the slack. Even as some private insurers are getting out of the long-term care market, the federal government is stepping in. As soon as 2013, working adults could have premiums deducted from their paychecks automatically, like a payroll tax. You'd be allowed to opt out of the program, but if you don't, you're entitled to about $50 a day in long-term care. Also, your employer has to decide whether to participate in the government program.
Employers are more and more impacted by employees' family members needing care.
Claude Thau is a consultant to the industry. He says the government plan could end up breathing life into the private market by encouraging employers to bring up the subject with employees. What this industry needs most of all, he says, is for lots of people to just start planning for their own ending. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
2010 did not go out with a bang on Wall Street. Details when we do the numbers. It was the year of healthcare reform and financial reform, and the year we were waiting to see if the economy started to recover. Whether that happened is a matter of opinion. To do the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond, we have Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Good to be here, Bob.
Great to be here.
Okay, so to start off, we're going to go back to last year at this time when we had Felix Salmon and John Carney on the weekly wrap. Here's what Felix had to say.
2010 is going to be the year that we find out whether the real economy can recover. The unemployment problem, the demand problem, the fact that the entire planet is suffering from the fact that there's no big U.S. consumer-led demand.
Well, there's a laundry list for you. So, Sudeep, where are we? Have we seen a recovery this year?
Well, Bob, we did see some meaningful improvement in the real economy. Consumers are spending again. Manufacturing is slowly improving. Business confidence is up. Not just big businesses, but small ones are starting to recover too. So as far as a test year for the economy, we proved that the economy can pull out of a crisis and produce some jobs, but we're just far from fixed.
Lee, what do you think?
I would agree with Sudeep. If you look just what happened with retail sales over the holiday season, it looks like they might actually end up beating 2007, which is pretty significant. Also, corporate profits in the third quarter were the highest ever on record. One of the things that also came up in the broadcast last year was that it might be a tricky year, and it certainly was a very tricky year. You know, the European debt crisis hit, and then things sort of fell apart, and they started to come back again in August. So it's been kind of a little bit of a jolting year, but I think overall we're headed in the right direction.
Let's switch gears and drill down on a sector of our economy that had a good year, tech. I just saw a headline today, Facebook surpasses Google as the most visited site in the U.S. Of course, Google isn't suffering. A few weeks ago, they made a $6 billion offer for Groupon but got turned down, which really underscores how big tech was this year. How important was that overall, Lee?
Tech is one of the biggest stories in business this year. If you look at what's happening in Silicon Valley, it operates sort of differently from the economy and Wall Street back here in New York where I am. I mean, but it is a huge story. I mean, just Facebook alone had – this was a year where it really evolved and it has become a tremendously important company. If you look what's happening at Apple, Apple's growth has continued to outpace what anybody thought it would do. I mean, iPhone sales in the third quarter were up something like 90%. I mean, it seemed like everybody already has one and yet it's still just really cranking. And so – you know, there's a lot happening out there. We're also in the middle of a big, big startup boom. These things kind of come in waves in Silicon Valley, and we are in the middle of just a really, really lush time for startups.
I wonder, given the success, what does it say about the ability of the economy going forward? I mean, these are all U.S. companies, Apple, Facebook, Google, Citi.
Well, that's all a great sign for the overall economy because you have from Apple consumer products doing very well and showing that people still want to buy. And for tech components, companies that make servers and computers and software and routers, those are all actually doing very well, which is a sign that the business community is starting to buy into the idea of a recovery and buying some of those products. And as Lee said, startups are just really an important sign for the business cycle, because startups are actually a critical piece of job creation. And it's actually a pretty good sign that you're on the road to something beyond just a cyclical short-term recovery.
Counting down to the new year, Lee, do you have any predictions for us for 2011? More of the same, or any surprises for our economy?
You know, I think we're going to see a lot of IPOs this year, partially because of the startup boom. But I think what we don't know is, what is the unknown? You know, I mean, are we going to have another flash crash? Is there going to be another, you know, Madoff-style story, something that just comes out of left field? That's something we can't predict for, and we've seen a lot of those. So we'll see what happens.
Sudeep, I'm going to put you on the line here. Any predictions?
Well, we largely escaped the prospect of a double-dip recession in 2010, and I think for 2011, it's going to be a test year of a different kind to see if the economy can recover without triggering either inflation problems or our own debt crisis in the U.S. We haven't had either one. The U.S. has been seeing a deflation threat for the past year or two, and our government has been able to borrow very, very cheaply, and so it's going to be a test for the U.S. as we come out of this, whether we can avoid those same problems that China and India and Europe are seeing, and whether it's inflation or debt.
We'll check back with you in a year. Thank you, and Happy New Year. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
So you thought you were done with gift giving? Consider if you have a small child, and there does seem to be something in the water around here, Marketplace, you can probably expect to attend a bunch of other kids' birthday parties in the year ahead. What to buy that five-year-old playmate of your kids you don't know very well? Sally Herships reports on one possible solution, gift registries for kids.
I'm in Maplewood, New Jersey, about to hit a party.
Happy birthday to you.
It's for one-year-old Asher Friedland. He has an older sister, so his mom, Danielle, has lots of birthday experience. But this year, she tried something new, registering for gifts for both kids.
My daughter's five. She doesn't tell me that much about her friends.
Friedland says picking out presents for other people's kids can be tough. Registries, she says, are convenient. So, are gift registries for kids tacky, or do they just have a bad rap? Time for another party.
Okay, can I take coats?
Birthday boy David Lavender is two. His family lives in Brooklyn. While his mom, Nora, cooked lunch for the partygoers, she told me a registry could seem rude, but she likes the idea of being able to suggest presents.
We have limited funds, so the idea of like saying these are the kind of clothes we like has some appeal to it, although I didn't register for him. It's probably the tacky factor. Although, I registered for my wedding, so I guess it's not that different.
Or is it? I'm still confused. So I asked Amy Dickinson. She writes the syndicated Ask Amy column.
In my view, the whole idea of registering for gifts for a one-year-old is cuckoo crazy.
Dickinson says a birthday for a young kid should be a family celebration, not a gift grab. And she says parents who register could miss out.
I'm a mother of five, and I might want to give your one-year-old something that you haven't thought of.
But Asher's mom, Danielle Friedland, says she tried to make her kids' registries thoughtful, and she only gave out information if people asked. Well, at least there's one group who just doesn't care.
What did you get?
Cards, Spider-Man, Toy Story!
I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, the meaning and the money behind one little pastry.
It's a way of showing respect to business partners and people that you want to be close to.
But first, let's do the numbers. What if they had a trading session and nobody came? That's just about summing up today's Wall Street action, or lack of it. Trading volume was way down, one of the lowest levels all year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 7 points, around a tenth of 1%, to end the trading day and the year at 11,577. The NASDAQ Composite Index went the other direction. It slipped 10 points, around a third of a percent, to finish at 2652. The S&P 500 hardly budged. It slipped a fraction to close virtually flat and capped the year at 1257. For all of 2010, all major stock indexes are up more than 14% when you include dividends. By that reckoning, the NASDAQ advanced 18% during the year. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for November. The Institute for Supply Management releases its manufacturing index for December. And time to take the tree down and get serious. Some of the top New Year's resolutions listed on USA.gov are get a better job, get fit, and manage stress. You'll have to do it all while drinking less alcohol and quitting smoking. Those are on there too, in case you're taking suggestions. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ristall. Did you know nonprofits collect as much as 40% of their donations around this time of year? It's not just the spirit of giving, it's the last chance tax deduction. Thus all those pitches clogging your mailbox lately. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports on his experience with the deluge of donor appeals.
I know it sounds backwards, but charities send money to me, like this nickel. It came taped to a fundraising letter. The appeal reads, "We make every nickel work as hard as possible." Really? Is sending money to strangers the most effective way to increase giving? I'll get back to that question in a minute. First, let's consider just how much charity junk mail the average person gets.
My name is Carol McBride, and I am pushing 90. I'm 89.
For the past few years, Carol McBride has cataloged all the mail she gets from fundraisers.
Just today, I received 66 address labels, 3 notepads, 10 Christmas cards, a little magnifier, and a batch of Christmas gift tags.
McBride says she doesn't donate much because she doesn't have much to donate, and she generally supports the same causes year after year. Still, she doesn't mind being courted by other charities within reason.
What I really don't like is the repetition from one company over and over and over and over again during the year.
That's a frustration shared by many Americans. Ken Berger, president of Charity Navigator, says the overload of solicitations could backfire.
It actually doesn't just damage that charity. It damages the trust that many donors have in the sector as a whole because they're getting it from all different angles. And, you know, at a certain point, you can develop a general frustration with the whole lot of them for all this junk I'm getting.
Junk, to him, might be described by fundraisers as a premium. That could be anything from a calculator to a T-shirt to a tote bag. Remember the nickel I received in the mail? Children's Hospital Los Angeles says for every nickel it spends on the campaign, it makes a dime. The money helped pay for a new $600 million hospital. Ron Bell is president of ad agency Target Market Team. He says giving away coins can be smart business.
Many of the things you get in the mail, like greeting cards or something like that, are typically much more expensive than just 5 cents. And so in reality, although people say, why are you mailing out money, it's actually a fairly inexpensive premium.
Direct mail is still more effective than the internet in terms of fundraising, but direct mail is not exactly environmentally friendly. To attract just one new donor, nonprofits need to send about 200 pieces of mail. That's tons of paper in the trash. Again, Ken Berger with Charity Navigator.
The vast majority of people don't even open the envelopes, so it really is a tragedy, an environmental tragedy, this junk mail that is such a waste.
I emailed half a dozen environmental groups asking if wasteful direct mail campaigns undermine their goal of saving the planet. Just one replied. Jenny Powers is spokesperson for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
We recognize the environmental impacts of direct mail, and that's why we've taken steps to make sure we do it as sustainably as possible.
The NRDC sends all its correspondence on recycled paper. I probably shouldn't cast stones myself. I mean, direct mail is hardly unknown in public radio. Of course, when it's your own cause, junk mailers aren't just landfill. They're somebody's salary. Maybe somebody like me. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace. Tonight we usher in a new year, but the Chinese won't ring in their new year till February 3rd, the year 4709, the year of the rabbit. It's the longest and most important festival on the Chinese lunar calendar, and that means lots of presents, decorations, and food, including mooncakes. No, that's not my nickname, thankfully. Mooncakes are pastries, small but rich, with a flaky crust and a sweet filling made of lotus paste. They're a popular holiday treat, meaning that the people selling them can cook up quite a business this time of year. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz looked inside the mooncake economy for this year's Mid-Autumn Festival, and it was such a yummy piece, we brought it back.
Mooncakes have been likened to pastry hockey pucks. At around 1,000 calories, they're almost as dense. This helps explain why the Chinese don't buy mooncakes for themselves. They gift them. Sean Rain is a strategy consultant in Shanghai.
It's a way of showing respect to business partners and people that you want to be close to. And it's an also way to give them outright bribes.
Yes, bribes. And we're not talking about briefcases full of mooncakes, but they're paper representations, mooncake vouchers. Here's how it works. Buy a voucher from a company that makes mooncakes, give it to your friend, client, local government official, and they, in theory, redeem the voucher for mooncakes. What most people do, though, is sell the vouchers on the black market for cash.
There's no embarrassment about saying that we don't want this mooncake. Let's be pragmatic and get some money out of it.
And when a fifth of the world is in on this, that money becomes an underground economy worth billions. Dozens of workers pack boxes of mooncakes at a Häagen-Dazs redemption center in Shanghai. 13 years ago, the company had an epiphany. They realized the Chinese give mooncakes, but many don't eat them. It's like the Christmas fruitcake dilemma in the West. So they thought, why not make ice cream mooncakes? The ice cream mooncake was born. Gary Chu manages the company's China operation.
It's a huge business. It's a very important business for us, and it's growing at a double digits every year.
Soon after, Starbucks, Nestle, and Dairy Queen got into the business. This year, Häagen-Dazs sold 1.5 million boxes. To buy one, you'll need $50 to $100 worth of vouchers. Want an ice cream mooncake this year? Sorry, vouchers are sold out. Your only option is the black market. A back-alley vendor named Yin Jing wears a fanny pack full of Häagen-Dazs mooncake vouchers. They're made of thick paper. Each one has a laser-engraved hologram, just like currency. They float like currency, too. Last week, their price peaked. Now, with just days to go before the festival, Mr. Yin is looking to unload.
After the festival's over, all these vouchers will be expired, so I have no choice. I've got to start dropping the price.
This selling frenzy reaches the highest levels of society. Just blocks away, a vendor who only gives his surname, Zhang, just negotiated a deal on reams of vouchers.
These are all from government officials. They get so many as gifts, they feel too embarrassed to sell them to me in person. So they ask their wives to meet me in a coffee shop.
Fresh from his secret government rendezvous, Zhang's got his game face on, trying to sell all these vouchers before his time runs out. If he fails, he'll be forced to succumb to the spirit of the season by giving away dozens of boxes of mooncakes and keeping a few for himself, at which point the giving will stop and the losers of this annual game will be forced to eat. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
By the way, you can see photos of Shanghai's underground mooncake economy, and for that matter, just take a look at what a mooncake is on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Here we are. It's a Friday and the last one of the year. So here's a taste of the best bits of news in 2010 that didn't quite make the headlines. Courtesy of Brendan, Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff, every time around this year, it all started with this simple question.
What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Designer abductions. It's a new French company that will allow people to pay $1,200 to be kidnapped.
Well, I'm going to be talking about a library book borrowed by our President George Washington, and it was finally returned this week, 221 years late.
What's the return fees on that?
$300,000.
Well, there's a new study out that found that more than 90% of U.S. toddlers have an online presence, like an email address or a social, like a Facebook page or something.
This could explain Twitter.
Yes.
Well, India and Bangladesh have been fighting over this mile-long island since the 1970s, and a researcher was looking at satellite photographs this weekend. The island's gone.
What?
Yeah, they assumed that because of global warming, it just disappeared back into the sea.
But now there's going to be a new war as pacifists and environmentalists fight over who gets the use of that metaphor.
Iceland. Obviously, they've been having problems with, you know, bank crises and volcanoes and stuff. So the manager of tourism asked Icelanders all around the world to email everybody they knew a message of love about Iceland and what a great place it is.
Wait, so let me get this straight. They're using spam to make themselves more popular? Way to go.
So in Holland, some thieves waited till some inmates from a Dutch prison were let out on furlough and stole the TVs from their rooms.
They stole TVs from a prison?
Yeah, it's win-win, because if they get caught, they get to watch the TVs anyway.
This trader just got fined $100,000. He got drunk, and he bought $500 million worth of oil futures.
Did that pay off for him?
Actually, his company lost $10 million, and he actually pushed the price of oil up to a record high last year.
I think we owe this guy a great debt. It's like no matter what mistakes we make while drunk, at least we didn't buy $500 million in oil futures.
I know. I feel so much better about a couple of really unfortunate karaoke incidents.
Rico and Brendan have put together a half-hour-long Best of 2010 episode of their Dinner Party Download. And we've got more year-end coverage of all the big business stories at Marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 7 points, around a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq lost 10 points, a third of a percent. The S&P 500 slipped less than a point to close virtually flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on our weekend show, Marketplace Money, hotels are going green by skipping daily room cleanings.
We've seen as much as a 25% loss of work hours in our housekeeping department.
That means they're cutting jobs in the name of environmental friendliness. I'm Bob Moon. Happy New Year. Hope you'll come back and join us in 2011.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.